On March 16, 2000, two sheriff's deputies were shot in Atlanta. Jameel Al-Amin, a Muslim leader and former Black Power activist, was convicted. But the evidence was shaky, and the whole truth didn't come out during the trial. My name is Mosi Secret, and when I started investigating this case in my hometown, I uncovered a dark truth about America. From Tenderfoot TV, Campside Media, and iHeart Podcasts, Radical is available now. Listen to the new podcast, Radical, for free on the iHeart Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's time for one of the biggest hiring events of the year. On September 22nd, Amazon Warehouse Hiring Day will be in your area to showcase all of the things you can get from a warehouse job. There'll be swag, a photo booth, giveaways, and more. Plus, learn about the work, competitive pay, and great benefits. You could even get a job offer on the spot. To find a hiring event close to you, visit amazon.com/hiringday. That's amazon.com/hiringday. Amazon is an equal opportunity employer.
You're listening to The Dossier, presented by Metro by T-Mobile.
It's time for one of the biggest hiring events of the year. On September 22nd, Amazon Warehouse Hiring Day will be in your area to showcase all of the things you can get from a warehouse job. There'll be swag, a photo booth, giveaways, and more. Plus, learn about the work, competitive pay, and great benefits. You could even get a job offer on the spot. To find a hiring event close to you, visit amazon.com/hiringday. That's amazon.com/hiringday. Amazon is an equal opportunity employer.
Action Park Media.
As we enter the year 2021, it now has been 24 years that the murder of Biggie has remained unsolved. There is no one that has done more investigative work as a journalist in this case than author Randall Sullivan. Randall first published the book Labyrinth in 2002. It told the complete story of Russell Poole's investigative work and the LAPD corruption that ended his career. In June of 2019, Randall then released Dead Wrong, a follow-up book to Labyrinth.
It's time for one of the biggest hiring events of the year. On September 22nd, Amazon Warehouse Hiring Day will be in your area to showcase all of the things you can get from a warehouse job. There'll be swag, a photo booth, giveaways, and more. Plus, learn about the work, competitive pay, and great benefits. You could even get a job offer on the spot. To find a hiring event close to you, visit amazon.com/hiringday. That's amazon.com/hiringday. Amazon is an equal opportunity employer.
In reading Randall's new book, it's startling to see in black and white the immense amount of evidence that is still being hidden in this case. Randall had unique access to Perry Sanders and the vast trove of information he holds as it relates to the civil case against the city of Los Angeles and the LAPD. Rumors continue to swirl that Perry and his team are hard at work trying to possibly refile this case. But the stakes with that might be too high. Randall agreed to sit down with me and Phil Carson for a wide-ranging conversation.
It's time for one of the biggest hiring events of the year. On September 22nd, Amazon Warehouse Hiring Day will be in your area to showcase all of the things you can get from a warehouse job. There'll be swag, a photo booth, giveaways, and more. Plus, learn about the work, competitive pay, and great benefits. You could even get a job offer on the spot. To find a hiring event close to you, visit amazon.com/hiringday. That's amazon.com/hiringday. Amazon is an equal opportunity employer.
Falling back into routine can be stressful. That's why Family Dollar has more to help you stay ahead of the class. Stock your pantry and save with snacktime favorites like cereal, cookies, crackers, and Tyson frozen chicken. Family Dollar, helping you do more.
The things that I think Phil and I have tried to do in looking at this story is show the general public the massive amounts of information and evidence that exist. And this isn't speculation. This is stuff that's written in documents. These are documents that exist. The first name I want to run by you that isn't a name that is talked a lot, and you do talk about him in your book, is a guy by the name of Kendrick Knox. Can you explain to people who Kendrick Knox is and why you think he's important to this story?
Kendrick Knox was what was called senior lead officer in the West Valley Division of LAPD. They're sort of a designated, I mean, they're not they don't have a rank like sergeant or anything like that, but they are like the very top cop in a division. And they do a lot of community interface and interaction. And he was dealing with all these complaints about the problems at a studio in Encino that had been leased by Shug Knight and Death Row Records. So you had a, you know, very suburban neighborhood with a lot of gangbangers parking their cars in their driveways and confrontations. And, you know, so he thought he was just kind of walking into that to try to smooth relations between these two separate cultures. And he found out that, LAPD officers were working for Death Row and in and out of the studio. And then what made that so significant is that he tried to proceed with that investigation. The moment he went public about it in the LAPD, his life got turned upside down. And he, not only was the investigation shut down, but he was basically scared into silence. All of the investigation that he'd done was erased, literally erased from his computer. He was warned not to speak about it anymore. The only thing, only reason I know about it and it's all come out is that before this shutdown happened, he gave a copy of his entire file to Russell Poole, who gave it to me.
Pretty incredible. And is it true that his hard drive at the LAPD was also wiped clean?
Yeah. You know, he had a back injury, went away for a while, came back. And they'd already told him the investigation was shut down and he wasn't supposed to speak about it to anyone. He wasn't allowed to have to even mention the subject. And he was getting some, threatening exchanges with officers who might be implicated. So he went on leave with his bad back. When he came back, the file that, he'd given Poole a copy of the file, but he had another one in his office that was gone. All of his evidence that he collected was gone. But what really scared him was when he went on the senior lead officer computer where all of his files had been digitalized and it was all wiped clean.
You know, when I first read Dead Wrong, I had this visceral reaction of how is it possible that all of this information exists and yet we sort of stand here today in 2021 without this being solved. So some of the questions I will ask you are sort of moments in your book where I read and shook my head. One of those is we do know Fred Miller was Russell Poole's partner at the LAPD's robbery homicide division. And you can correct me if I'm wrong about my analysis on this. Fred Miller was a guy who kind of, would tell Russ to like just fall in line, like you don't want these problems. Then come to find out at the civil trial when Fred Miller testified, is it correct that he testified that towards the end of his career, he felt that he wanted to build a case on Shug Knight and the evidence was there to build a case on Shug Knight as it relates to the murder?
Yes. In fact, he took it to the district attorney.
And completely turned down.
Well, he had to go through his supervisors to take it to the district. He couldn't do that directly. So he didn't get to actually speak to the district attorney's office, but he was told by his supervisors that you were almost there, but not quite there in terms of arresting Shug. And, at the same time, he was getting, warned that, you're stepping into a minefield here and do you really want to do this? Miller ended up having a little more loyalty to Russ Poole than a lot of people thought. He believed Russ had done a good job and was, an earnest, honest detective. And I think that Miller was actually a little more of a decent guy than I initially imagined him to be. And so he did take that one last shot at it, swing at it, trying to get Shug charged. But when they told him no go, he just backed away.
You know, we both have spoken to Kenneth Boagne in the story that he tells. There is a part of the story I wasn't aware of, and that is you have reported that Boagne went as far as offering to wear a wire on Rafael Perez inside jail. He offered this to LAPD investigators who seemingly turned Boagne down. Correct?
That is absolutely correct. Well, that's what Boagne says. I mean, but there was a LAPD officer who was sort of the liaison in the, Board of Rights hearing where Boagne first appeared, where he first testified publicly about all this, and he confirmed that that had happened to me.
Another fascinating character in all of this is Detective Steve Katz. Katz with hidden files in his desk. Talk me through just your analysis of Steve Katz and these hidden files in a locked drawer. This alone, to me, it's still, I think, how this has not completely reopened the case, if not, you know, shattered and brought down the house, I don't know. But what's your overall at this day analysis of Steve Katz?
Well, I mean, you know, at the time of the discovery, it was sort of a bombshell, and it did result in a mistrial. And, you know, the city and LAPD were sanctioned $1 million, and, you know, and for the time they'd wasted of the, you know, hiding this. And you know, so a new trial was supposed to happen. I mean, there was no doubt what happened. It was, you know, as the judge said at the time, this is like pages and pages of documents and all of the things that somehow he lost or forgot about. That was his story. They were in this file were things that implicated LAPD officers in Biggie's murder. So, you know, it was pretty obvious to the judge that this was not just an accident. And that was, you know, why the fine was so large. But the LAPD essentially took the position, and the person I'd really like to hear from about this, how he could possibly justify it, is William Bratton, who took over the LAPD later, but he went along with the story that Katz had just, you know, forgotten about this stuff and was just an oversight, and, you know, and the poor guy was, you know, being crucified for what was just a, you know, bit of carelessness. And they kept trying to sell that story, and they never had to really explain it to anyone because, well, in large part because they, you know, never held to account by the media in Los Angeles or any of the other, you know, any of the other institutions, you know, the U.S. Attorney's Office, District Attorney's Office, or any of the other people that could have gotten involved and taken a good look at this. But it was really a lesson to me in how much power the LAPD has and how it reaches into so many other parts of the government, and but also, you know, in civilian life too. I mean, people do not want to cross the LAPD.
Hey, Randall, sure. Within those documents that were found inside of Steve Katz's desk, were there any photos that was part of that, or was it all just strictly like, you know, documentation of things? You know,
well, what was found was sealed. So all I ever really knew, other than what may have been leaked to me by some people, was the judge's summary of what it was. So, you know, all that was described to me were, you know, documents and tape recordings.
I'm just curious of some of the photos that I originally saw in the LAPD murder file, as well as did another FBI agent that was with me. And then they somehow disappeared from the murder file. And we then documented that we not only saw these pictures, but a signed letter from my supervisor to Katz in the LAPD specifically asking to see any photos, but in particular, these certain photos that we had seen. And we never got, and Katz denied ever having those. I'm just curious if those photos were taken out of the murder. We know they were taken out of the murder book, but were they stashed as part of these documents that were being hidden by Katz? Because we never got an answer. We just were told, no, those photos that you saw outside the Peterson that, you know, that showed, you know, that had Mac, Perez, Amir, Big Gene, Puffy, that those photos didn't exist when, which is just ridiculous because we know they existed. We saw them. I don't think people have ever found those photos. And I'm wondering, they may be part of that sealed documentation then. I mean, does that make sense?
It's conceivable, Phil, but I, you know, it's also conceivable that they just disappeared them. I mean, I know that's what happened to the photographs of Mac and Perez with Michelle Parks, Chief Park's daughter. That photograph was made to disappear. In fact, an officer.
That's crazy.
An officer has come forward to say that, you know, he was the one assigned to make it disappear.
It's amazing. You write about when Perry Sanders goes to question Puffy. In the room that day are two officers from LAPD's risk management division that come along for that particular. Yeah. Here's what I feel about LAPD's risk management. I feel that was an area of the LAPD where they buried the bodies. And I might be wrong about that, but I feel it was an area that could be controlled by a handful of people, i.e. a guy by the name of Sal Piscopo and a few others. And that's where they really controlled the documents or the evidence that they didn't want public, or they didn't want anyone to see, for that matter. What do you feel about LAPD's risk management and this particular? It just struck me as odd, as why is risk management there when Puffy's being questioned?
I think you're absolutely right about that. It's probably the most secretive part of the LAPD. It's kind of like internal affairs, only even more, narrower and more targeted. I mean, their whole point in risk management's job is to protect the LAPD, to protect the LAPD from any exposure, legal exposure, litigation exposure. Supposedly, they're supposed to find all of the evidence and process it and, bring it forward. But, everybody knows that's not really their job. Their job is to do whatever they can to filter it so that, nothing damaged to the LAPD gets through. And, if you get that gig, if you're on that unit, you're on the, track to promotion and, high rank, just as with IA, although this is even more elite. So most of those people who get that kind of a position aren't going to jeopardize careers that are flourishing and that have a big back end. So it's really impenetrable. I mean, I've had some IA people leak me some stuff, but I've never had any of those risk management people give me the time of day. So that tells you something.
Sure. And the next document I'm going to talk about, I can actually email it to you so that you can look at it. But I have a few contexts, and I wanted to read you something that I'm curious about what your thoughts on. It's a legal filing that in January of 2001, the LAPD instituted a formal internal affairs investigation bearing LAPD Internal Affairs number CF010190. In this IA, the LAPD itself alleged that Mack and Perez conspired to murder and assisted in the murder of Mr. Wallace. Have you ever heard of this LAPD internal affairs report? Have you seen it?
Yeah.
It obviously exists. Yeah. What's your analysis of that?
I have a copy of it. Basically, that document is, damning as that looks. This was what they used to basically bury what surfaced out of the Boagne investigations. Boagne and Felipe Sanchez, the two inmates who had been, in jail with Perez and reported what they'd been told. So they had no choice but to acknowledge that there had been an accusation, especially after the, actually before the mistrial. But, once it was on the record, they had to acknowledge that there had been an accusation that Mack and Perez and I think Sammy Martin were involved in Biggie's murder. So, but if you read through the whole thing, they did absolutely nothing. I mean, their explanation is, yes, these accusations were made, but they were dismissed. And then the reason why, basically, because we didn't try to, investigate them. Their explanation for why their investigation didn't go anywhere is because they didn't do any investigating. It's almost comical.
Again, because you've showed me that document, that document exists. Everybody out there now knows it exists. And what the hell are people doing about it?
It was hidden. It did surface during the lawsuit. It was something that it was found. It was one of those things that after the mistrial and the LAPD was really under pressure, and somehow word of that it must exist got out. So the LAPD produced it the last second, months after they should have. And it was it caused the judge was very upset. I mean, this is obviously something you've been hiding from us, and it got on the record. But the problem was that the case itself was being basically sidelined and shut down by the LAPD. It's amazing. The LAPD shut down this federal lawsuit. They shut down the U.S. Attorney's offices investigation. You wouldn't think a municipal police department would have that much power, but they did.
That document does exist. I mean, like I said, Randy, you got a copy?
Don has a copy.
I've seen it. Everybody out there needs to know. This is an internal LAPD official document written by LAPD that exists. That's a given now. So either one of two things has to happen. One is LAPD has to say it doesn't exist. It's fabricated, which they can't do because It was filed in court under seal, so we know it does exist. So the only other option is do something about it. You can't just ignore it. It's like saying, yeah, we know who committed this murder, but we're not going to do anything about it.
The fact is, Phil, they can't ignore it. They are ignoring it. No, because there is agency. Nobody is putting any pressure on them to act on it. And the lawsuit was the only avenue, you know, to compel the LAPD to face it. But I got to say, I mean, the complicity of the Los Angeles Times in this is that, you know, if there'd been some media attention, if they'd reported it, if they'd actually done their job, then, you know, that might have, you know, shone a bright enough light on this to compel some action. But the Times completely ignored it. They knew about it, but they did not put one word in the newspaper about this document.
I'm going to assume, based on the assumption that a vast array of different people in different organizations of different levels have not only listened to this podcast, but now know about this document that exists. And in fact, Don, on a couple occasions now, has even provided the case file number. But for nobody to follow up on something like this, I can't even wrap my head around it. It's beyond comprehension. It really is.
When I read it, I was so flabbergasted. I mean, what flabbergasted me was they acknowledge this investigation. We've opened this investigation. And then they say we found nothing because we didn't look for anything. They basically say that.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing.
The second thing is that in the document, it says on July 1st, 2005, approximately 14 to 16 IA files regarding Mac, including the Mac Wallace murder IA, were removed from internal affairs by LAPD risk management employee officer Sal Piscopo and concealed in a cabinet in risk management.
How did the task force that was created in whatever it was, 2008, 2009, or whatever, with Katie and all the other LAPD and I think the FBI and DEA was part of that. Did they not have access to this document?
They
had no access because they didn't even know it existed, correct?
Look, somebody may have told him, who knows with Katie, but the fact is that his assignment was to, you're not going to look at any of the that implicates LAPD officers in this murder. And you're not going to get it. You're not going to look at it. You're not going to consider it. You're going to find some alternative theory of this case that doesn't involve LAPD officers. And Kading took that assignment. And, you know, and that's why it's so funny to me when he shows pictures of his vast, you know, file cabinets of evidence, that it doesn't have any of the most important evidence in it. You know, I asked him, well, did you have the interview with Eugene Deal or the Kendrick Knox affidavit or his investigation or all of the stuff that's the most important evidence in the case? He's never seen any of it, including this stuff.
That's why it just, I mean, the whole, and again, I don't want to turn this into a Greg Cady bashing, but that's what's so mind-boggling to me is he never reached out to Russ Poole. He never reached out to me. I was still an FBI agent back when they were doing this. And the interesting part is I had the entire case file of Russ Poole. It's documented that, you know, I can talk about it now because he's deceased, but he was an FBI informant. And we had his entire case file. And it's funny how the LAPD wiped clean his entire case file, but the LAPD didn't know that Russ Poole was working with me. And then I had his entire case file. And it only somehow, when it leaked out, that's when the LAPD said, oh shit, we can't have Agent Carson testify because we know that he's seen all of Russ Poole's work. We know what Phil Carson has done as well, on top of what had already been done by Russ Poole and the LAPD investigation. And that's one of the reasons why, when they found out that I was put on a witness list, that they said, no, we cannot afford to have him get up there and testify because we know what he knows because we wiped these files clean and now there's no record. So Katie has never even seen, and this is the one thing that kind of, it does get my, get underneath my skin, is when Katie says, or he just tries to discredit Russ Poole, or he says that, oh, that's old and tired. Well, yeah, that's the truth though.
And sometimes when the truth, it's the truth today, it is tomorrow, and it's going to be the truth 5, 10, 20 years from now. So I guess the alternative is just to make up some bullshit narrative and say, hey, here's something new and different. Why don't we go ahead and push this narrative and write a book and do a TV series about it, which is just a joke.
It worked for Kading because it worked for the LAPD. The LAPD, yeah. I don't think they think highly of Greg Kading, but he served them by what he did. He did by his investigation and his book. So they're not going to cross him because he's basically covering their asses. And,
I just don't understand.
In terms of you being on the witness, I'm telling you, I've talked to people, who knew that if Phil Carson gets on the stand, we are dead. The city of L.A. is going to be on the hook for, who knows, maybe $1 billion, certainly.
Yeah, they came to the FBI and talked to me and all my bosses. They actually reached out to me, and I set up the meeting, and they came over, and that's exactly what they said. It's exactly what's documented. And I'm still just blown away why people out there, and I'm not just saying Greg Kade, I'm just saying other people as well, keep trying to shoot down Russ Poole's work. The guy was a stellar detective. He did great investigative work, not only on the Biggie case, but on several other homicide cases, which is exactly why he got chosen to investigate the Biggie murder. And it's factual. These things are documented. And I'm not saying just documented by Russ Poole. I've gone out and I've not only corroborated some of that stuff, but then I was able to take things further because of the resources I had and was able to find more evidentiary things that have been documented. And I just don't understand why some people out there keep saying, oh, no, this is an old and tired narrative. This isn't correct. It's just bullshit. It's a joke. It is 100% correct. And I don't understand why people that have never seen all the evidence, have never seen the work of the FBI, have never seen the work of Russ Poole, continue to shoot down the theory of LAPD's involvement in orchestrating and obstructing not only the FBI case, but their involvement in the murder. It's mind-blowing to me that people just sit back and just now accept that sometimes because that's what LAPD wants. I don't get it, man. It goes against everything that law enforcement stands for.
Well, it's just the case, Phil, where the powers that be, there was a lot of collusion. It was, you could call me a conspiracy theorist if you like, but there was a lot of collusion between these different agencies and institutions who were all of them were involved in it initially. I mean, it was sort of a cascading thing. There were mistakes made at the beginning. There were lies told or small cover-ups, made. But they were connected to larger and larger events, and the whole thing just swelled. And by the time they realized that there's this tidal wave looming over us, we just have to get out from under it, and any way we can. And Kading offered them a convenient out. He's got the killer is conveniently dead. His source is somebody who was given immunity from another crime where she would have gone to jail for a long time. And Suge Knight, the one person, if you made a deal with her and Pucci's dead. So, what about Suge Knight? I mean, that's who is behind it all, right? And usually when an LAPD detective solves a murder, they go out and arrest the guilty party, but he never arrested Suge. And he really can't explain it.
Yeah, and I think that just to put another person into the mix is Russ Poole came to the conclusion. Phil, you came to the conclusion. And then Sergio Robledo also came to that same conclusion. So you have three investigators, and then you have Kading on the other side. And that, to me, has always been the nail in the coffin when it comes to this. So you're saying three of your credibilities are shot, three of you are incompetent. And if you look at the track records of the three individuals, Poole, Carson, and Robledo, they're almost impeachable, I think that's where the conversation ends for me,
Immerse yourself in the fascinating tale of Song of Solomon by the legendary Pulitzer Prize winning author, Toni Morrison, a mesmerizing coming of age masterpiece that has captivated readers around the world. Follow the protagonist, Milkman Dead, who was born shortly after a neighborhood eccentric hurled himself off a roof in a vain attempt at flight. For the rest of his life, Milkman, too, will be trying to fly. As Morrison follows Milkman on a quest to uncover his roots and himself in his Rust Belt hometown, to the place of his family's origins, she introduces an entire cast of Shrivers and Cirruses, liars and assassins, the inhabitants of a fully realized black world. As the New Yorker put it, Morrison moves easily in and out of the lives and thoughts of her characters, luxuriating in the diversity of circumstances and personality. Whether you're a seasoned reader or new to Toni Morrison, Song of Solomon is a must-read that will ignite your imagination and leave you wanting to read more Morrison. Song of Solomon, a timeless tale that will stay with you long after you've turned its final page. Available now at tonimorrison.com and wherever books are sold. All right, so life doesn't happen bi-weekly, so why should payday? The money you earn can be in your hands today with EarnIn. EarnIn is an app that gives you access to your pay as you work, up to $100 per day, or up to $750 per pay period. Just download the EarnIn app and verify your paycheck. Then access up to $100 a day as you work and leave an optional tip. Any money you access plus tips are automatically repaid from your next paycheck. So maybe you need to get your kids something special, or you and the wife need a scintillating night out, every once in a while at least. So download EarnIn today, spelled E-A-R-N-I-N, in the Google Play or Apple App Store. When you download the EarnIn app, type in the dossier under podcast. EarnIn is a financial technology company, not a bank. Subject to your available earnings, daily max, pay period max, and location. See earnin.com/TOS for details. Bank products are issued by Evolve Bank and Trust, member FDIC.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, if Kading had actually looked at the evidence, if he'd actually examined Russ Poole's case or Phil Carson's, investigation and, disproven it or found holes in it or said there's something wrong with it, but he did not do a damn thing to look into any of that. So that when he says that, we proved that was not the case, he didn't prove a thing. They didn't even try. They made no attempt to investigate the possibility.
Do you ever think he'll have a crisis of conscience at some point, or just come off of this bullshit that he still sits?
Kading, you talking about?
Yeah.
I got my opinion. What's your opinion, Randall?
My opinion is that even if Kading had a conscience, that I'm not sure he does, but if he did, he's still so invested, so deeply invested in this narrative. This
exactly.
It's made him. So, I mean, how does he ever come back from that? And if he did, then he'd face the wrath of the LAPD, because right now they will protect him. They have his back, because he's their boy. He's put out the story they want out there.
Sure. Another piece of evidence, Randall, is that I find kind of interesting, and I wanted your thoughts on this. Edward Henry, who was the stepbrother of Detective Stephen Katz, told LAPD detectives that Katz had told him that he was aware of information and documents implicating individuals associated with the LAPD in the murder of Christopher Wallace. Henry advised that LAPD, or Katz had stated, such materials had been placed in the forgotten file, that the materials would stay in the drawer. It would be a cold case for the duration, and something to the effect of, fuck Biggie. He's going to be in the drawer for a while.
This was actually
not only a statement, this was a recorded interview with Ed and Henry's stepbrother. Have you heard of that?
I haven't, Patrick. This is new to me. And I mean, it sounds pretty significant, but so many things are. It's one more, you know, amazing revelation that somehow doesn't, you know, blow the lid off this thing.
I'll run one more thing by you and to see if you have ever heard this also. And again, I am not putting this forth as if this is 100% true, but I will just say that this exists and these things exist on audio and in paper that the LAPD knew since 1999 that David Mack confessed to being at the scene of the murder on the night of the murder. In the LAPD's paraphrased interview of an individual named Benny Keys, who had been incarcerated with Mack, stated that Mack indicated he was a member of the Blood Street Gang. He saw pictures of Mack wearing red. Have you ever heard of this individual, Benny Keys?
I have, and I do have a copy of his statement. And that came out fairly early, but it was another thing that just seemed to sort of disappear. It actually, the LAPD did, just like that IA report we were referring to earlier, it was one of those things that the LAPD finally came forward with after the mistrial, and only because the lawyers heard about it from somebody and demanded it specifically, and then the LAPD pretended to look for it in the forgotten evidence file or whatever it is, and then finally produced it.
Sure. The next thing I'd like, well, you to just also explain of what happened in the civil trial is here is another little paragraph I want to read for people to understand. It says that the city itself has engaged in a wide-ranging scheme to conceal virtually every piece of evidence which linked LAPD officers with the homicide at issue. Do you know how much, and I know that Perry is a friend to all of us, how difficult was it for Perry Sanders to be given discovery in this case, which is just traditional and when you do a civil trial?
Well, they didn't know how much was being hidden from them, you know, up to the time of the mistrial. But remember that right after the mistrial, the LAPD created Operation Transparency, which was, you know, Greg Kading's task force. And so once that, the purpose of that investigation wasn't even mainly to come up with an alternative theory that would, that the cops were involved. What it did was it gave LAPD the right to claim that there was an ongoing investigation and the case was about to break open. And they used that argument repeatedly in federal court to withhold evidence from the attorneys, from Perry and the other attorneys. And the judges, two different judges, including the one who made the mistrial ruling, you know, they bought it, you know, because you know, they didn't want to disrupt or overturn or expose. You know, it was like, if we give this information, we will destroy this investigation. You'll jeopardize the lives of informants, et cetera, et cetera. So they went along with that. And as soon as the case was terminated, I mean, we could talk about what really happened there too. But almost immediately, when the case was dismissed, like 2 weeks later, Operation Transparency was disbanded. The whole thing was shut down. It only existed as a way to withhold evidence from the lawyers representing the Wallace estate.
And I do think that is important, what you just stated, for people to really understand the what transpired. To get to that point, Biggie's mom, the estate, and Perry, they sue the city for wrongful death. And they are, is it fair to say, about a week from going to trial?
They were on the brink of trial. A trial date hadn't been set because, for one thing, you know, they kept hearing that there was this new evidence and they wanted to get a look at it. They were being put in the position of, you know, proceeding to trial. You know, all the lawyers explained this to me, and it is very lawyerly, but we can't go to trial not knowing what other evidence there is and what they might bring forward. And then it just coincided really with Valletta's exhaustion. You know, she won the mistrial. She felt she'd been vindicated. She was being treated for cancer, you know. Biggie's children had, you know, been growing up with this as, you know, their reality, and she didn't want them to have to live with it anymore. She didn't want the stress of it herself. So she went along with the dismissal. If it was the kind of dismissal was, you know, it wasn't like the case was over. initially, at least it wasn't. It was that we can refile at any time up to the time that the kids turn 21. And that, you know, that was written into the order. So at that time, it was like, well, let's wait. And by then, you know, maybe Greg Hayding and his people will actually have solved the case, or you know, something won't happen and we can go forward. But, you know, that never happened. And the trial was never picked up, and really nothing changed until Dead Wrong was published. And now we'll see. I mean, things
correct
are
me if I'm wrong, too, from here, that they can still refile the case because it was dismissed without prejudice, but LAPD still does not have to turn over everything. Is that correct?
Not now. What happened, you know, the case has been dismissed now, and the statute of limitations has expired. So the only way that you can reopen a case like that, and it's very hard to do, is if you can prove that evidence was intentionally concealed from you, and that was why the publication of Dead Wrong, you know, was what opened this back up again, is because they saw, especially in, you know, my interviews with you were a big part of it, that, you know, there was a lot of stuff hidden from us. There were all these machinations we had no idea about, and that is a basis for reopening it, maybe.
Exactly, which means because of all the information that was withheld, that is talked about, that is that gives you the basis or the foundation for refiling the case, correct?
Yeah.
I don't understand, it's
very rarely happens. A case that's been dismissed and the statute of limitations has expired, it's only happened, I think, like once or twice that a case has been allowed to be reopened and refiled on that basis, that information was hidden. And there is a path, but it's a narrow path. It's complicated. You know, without getting into things I maybe shouldn't say, but I mean, for the lawyers to file it, they are putting themselves at risk because they know for a fact that they've already been told that the LAPD and the city of Los Angeles are going to come back at them and sue them for suing. You know, they're going to sue the lawyers for suing the city and the police department if they try to reopen it. So they'd be putting, you know, themselves in tremendous jeopardy. But, you know, it's not, you know, right now it's pending. I honestly, I talked to Perry Sanders today and I can, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. I just know that that is probably the only possible path to some sort of justice in this case.
In the course of trying to achieve justice, that a lawyer could actually be sued for filing, I can't even wrap my head around it. It's unbelievable.
So basically, yeah, if Perry and his group do not refile, all the evidence that has been hidden that people know exists, but
it's locked in a vault.
Exactly. We know it exists, but nobody can look at it, is basically just going to just go away and nobody will ever take a look at it. I mean, that's in a nutshell, that's what's going to happen then, right?
That pretty much, yeah. I mean, I don't see any other avenue. I mean, I maybe the FBI has some path that I don't know about, but I don't think so. I think that unless, you know, these lawyers are able to find a way and have the nerve, and because I know, you know, they've got additional evidence, you know, that we haven't even talked about. In addition to all of that, though, and the fact is, though, if they put you on the stand, city's dead, just by yourself, you're going to win the case. But they have tons of other stuff. If the case ever gets in front of a jury, there's not even a shred of doubt in my mind or any of their minds that, you know, the city of LA will be on the hook for at least $1 billion and many heads.
But I mean, the documents that are under seal, locked in a vault somewhere in the federal courthouse, is there a time limit? You know, it's like whatever, you know, when the federal government decides to declassify something, and after 20 years or 30 years or 50 years or whatever, and then it becomes public knowledge and people are like, holy shit, you know, but nobody knows about that until, is that what this is?
No, I don't think there's like a ticking clock. I don't even think there's a ticking clock on this. I think it could stay, you know,
endless,
in that vault for, yeah. I mean, I don't think there's any mechanism force it out into public except the losses.
So all of the discovery, like the things that we talk about, that was handed over to Perry,
right? Those documents, as it stands still today, are under federal seal, correct?
Yes, they are.
Okay. And that gets me to my next question, because you do have a pretty interesting moment in your book, and it's a quote from Perry Sanders. And Perry Sanders says, when, and I don't know if this is still the case, when the proceedings are concluded, Perry Sanders promised that all evidence gathered, without exception, will be donated to a local public library so the public will be able to access this information without having to rely on the LA Times spin.
Yeah, he did say that. I talked to him that day, I remember it, and he was so furious. But the fact is, that'll be all the information in Perry's possession, all that was ever turned over by the LAPD, or that they acquired by some other means, but it isn't the stuff locked in the vault. Perry doesn't, you know, he's not seen that either.
Even outside of all of this discovery that they got caught hiding, like, let's call it the cat stuff, let's call it the Boagni material, the Mac sort of personnel files, all of this, it's the contention that there's even more shit that's hidden.
Oh, there's a lot more shit that's hidden. Everything that Operation Transparency dug up, everything that came in from the LAPD to be reviewed by the judge before it was given to the defense. And the judge agreed that, all right, this can be held, you know, as long as the investigation is ongoing. And then what happened, you know, that judge, who probably would have ruled at some point that, okay, this has gone on long enough, turn it over, she got sick and died, and a new judge was put on the case, and that judge ruled in favor of the LAPD across the board.
The irony is not lost that it was called Operation Fucking Transparency.
I agree.
I think I'll just pose this last question, because I think I have my analysis, and you did mention it and say that. I mean, with this narrow path, and you know, I've talked to Perry in the last month or so, and it's always him saying, "I'm trying." And I think for Phil and I, and I think for anyone who's not a lawyer, probably sits there and goes, well, what are you talking about? Like, look at this fucking evidence. But then you realize there's nuances to this of the legal system that we have no idea, right? Because Perry and Rob Frank and these guys, they're geniuses in this, right?
But even they, I mean, they, you know, they need a major civil rights firm. You know, they need a partner which would be a major civil rights firm. And a lot of them have been really leery because they'd be sued too. They'd risk being sued too. They would risk huge financial jeopardy. And there's no doubt that the city and the LAPD would try that. So the first hurdle is the only one that is really in the way. If they get over that hurdle with the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals that rules that, okay, it's clear there was a lot of important evidence hidden that could have made a difference in this case, and it's enough, it's convincing enough that we're going to let you reopen this lawsuit.
And is there a precedent for the situation Perry or anyone else for that matter has found themselves, where they, in bringing a civil lawsuit, could also then be sued for filing something?
That happens. I mean, you know, they're called flaps. They're basically, you know, because they're supposed to deter, frivolous or malicious. In this case, it would be malicious lawsuits. But I mean, you know, they'd be facing the resources of, you know, the entire city of Los Angeles, and with all the lawyers they could hire to sell that story. So, you know, that risk it's a large risk. What I know of the evidence, you know, and I know there is even more evidence that, you know, we can't even talk about now, but, you know, that would, I think, overwhelm, you know, anyone who heard it. I mean, I think the case would be an absolute slam dunk in front of the jury. It wouldn't even be close. It'd probably take 5 minutes. But you can't get that in front of a jury unless you get it past the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is very concerned about the precedent they'd be establishing. You know, it's a complex legal position to them, and it's only happened a couple of times. But there was, I'm told, a Supreme Court ruling that they think supports what they'd be doing, but it's never happened before the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit has never ruled to a case that's been dismissed and is past the statute of limitations can be reopened because of, you know, discovery of evidence that had been hidden. But it is legally possible. There's language in the law that would allow it to happen, but the standard is really high.
Phil, I actually have a question for you. Funny enough, I thought I ran out of it after having talked to you for so long. What's preventing an FBI agent from calling Perry Sanders on the phone and saying to Perry, I would love to see every single shred of evidence that was given to you and handed over to you in discovery? Is there anything preventing that from happening that would then lead them to be able to pursue a case?
Not that I know of. No, I don't think anything's stopping it from happening. But again, one of the things that I talked about in one of the earlier episodes on the podcast was, because of the knowledge that I had from the Rampart case, the Palmeros case, the Mac bank robbery case, and then the Biggie case, it was a culmination of all that information. And again, understanding when I took all that institutional knowledge from those cases, put it together in like a 10 or 12 page communication, and gave it to my bosses, and then they all read it. The FBI doesn't open up this case, a federal case, unless all my bosses sign off on it and understand that by signing off, they are saying that, yes, there is something here, and it involves the LAPD, orchestrating and eventually obstructing this case. But I don't open up a case by myself. And so they took a look at everything that I wrote up, and they said, absolutely run with it, which right there speaks volumes. I can't tell you how much that speaks. And so for another FBI agent, if they wanted to take a look at this, they've got my case file there. They've got my prosecutor report there. They've got Russ Poole's case file there. They've got everything right there. But they're just going to have to spend a lot of time also getting to know those other cases that I mentioned to get a full understanding of everything, because this was not some isolated incident by isolated police officers orchestrating it. If there's a pattern and it's all documented based on these other cases that actually came to fruition. I mean, there were prosecutions in Palmeros. There were prosecutions in Rampart. There were prosecutions in the the Mac bank robbery. So this isn't some he said, she said type thing. And it's all there. It's pretty voluminous, I can tell you that. And it just would take probably a few agents to really dig their heels in and dig into it. But again, I think one of the things it sounds like that they would possibly run into is trying to get some of this stuff from LAPD that I tried to get and was just shut down. I luckily was able to take a look at some stuff before they hit it. This document, Don, that you provided that case file number. What would happen if an FBI agent would say subpoena something like that, or request to get a copy of that, or call you up to get a copy of that? Is LAPD going to dispute that because it's under seal? I don't know, but it's all there. It's all there for the taking. But God knows if they're going to run into some roadblocks that, I never knew that. I never envisioned that I would run into the roadblocks that I did run into. And what lengths they went to try to discredit me and discredit the FBI. The problem is everything's documented, so they're wrong.
Outside of Perry and this, legal maneuvering that he's doing, in your heart of hearts, is there anyone that currently exists that, outside of the actual shooter coming forward and saying, I did this, is there an individual that could come forth that you feel would finally, the LAPD could not deny it, they could not discredit it, if you look, like, if Suge was to come out and say,
this is what I did. Do you even think they'd accept that at this point?
I'm not sure they would, actually. I mean, Chu would only be doing that if he was getting something for it. So whatever his deal would be, I mean, Chu would do that if it was going to get him out of prison. He wouldn't do it for any, you know, not to clear his conscience or anything like that. You know, there are some stones that still could be turned over, maybe. I mean, as Phil was talking, I was thinking, you know, the guy, the U.S. attorney who received the FBI's request to prosecute the case based on Phil's investigation. So I found the guy. He'd been the assistant U.S. attorney assigned to this case at the time. He's now a lawyer in private practice in L.A. So when I got him on the phone and told him what I was calling about, I mean, I could literally hear the guy shitting a brick. He was just in such stress. And finally, he said, I can't talk about this over the phone, you know, but you've got to send me anything in email. So I sent him all a list of all my questions, what I knew, you know, about the case and him in email. And he refused to reply and wouldn't ever take my calls again. But if somebody could squeeze the truth out of that guy about how and who convinced him that he couldn't prosecute this case, because as Phil probably already said, and Phil's the one who told me, this U.S. attorney, you know, he did not, typically U.S. attorneys, almost always U.S. attorneys, always actually, U.S. attorneys have to explain why they're rejecting a case from the FBI. They have to write a letter of declination laying out why. This is the only case I know where no letter of declination was ever provided. So the U.S. attorney's office, and that person in particular, know something about how this case got shut down and what powers pulled those strings. And that might lead to something.
Yeah. I continue to be surprised of just, you know, every time I sit down to like reread this stuff and relook at this stuff of how fucked up it is and how much of this exists. I think sadly enough for me that as the years go on, I think it's getting lost and lost in just everything else. And I hope that's not the case, but I don't know. I just feel with the work you've done alone and the stuff that exists, it's mind blowing that you just can't, the needle just can't seem to fucking move.
Believe me, I've never been this frustrated by anything in my entire career. You know, it does. It absolutely befuddles me. It astounds me. You know, I mean, you know, when Dead Wrong was published, I figured there were like 10 things in it the LA Times would have to put on the front page because they were that, you know, they were revelations that startling. But the LA Times, you know, completely ignored the book. And I don't think any, you know, I'm still, and of course, so did the law enforcement agencies in LA. So, like I said, I mean, I think there's just one avenue left. And, you know, we're all hoping that, you know, Barry Sanders and crew can, you know, find a way.
Yeah.
The anger of Phil Carson and the frustration of Randall Sullivan is palpable on this audio. See, to go down into the dark caverns of this case is to see in printed form actual evidence, documentation, and proof in plain sight that the LAPD not only covered up this crime, they did it right in front of everyone's face. The mechanisms of power in place that could have stopped this, like the LA Times or the United States Attorney in Los Angeles, all bowed down to the power of the almighty LAPD. I'm not a pessimist by nature, but let me be clear about a few things. No one inside hip-hop journalism has cared to look into the information Phil has, or Randall has, or I have. The attempts on my behalf to get anyone to pay attention has been an uphill battle. I have FBI files, LAPD files. I have files that show clear as day that LAPD cops were involved in the murder of Biggie. And you know what? Right now, I don't think anyone cares. As a country, we've had a reckoning around police corruption, criminal justice, defund the police. Yet, the biggest police cover-up by the biggest police agency in America is largely ignored as it relates to a global hip-hop superstar. As Randall explained towards the end, there's a narrow path that the family of Biggie and Perry Sanders have to get this case refiled against the city of Los Angeles, and that looks like a long shot. The FBI in Los Angeles also has the power to do something. But again, they alone can't bring a case. they would once again need the support of the U.S. attorney or a young prosecutor who maybe believes in justice. If not, all the information, all the evidence will remain in a vault somewhere at the LAPD, locked away, most likely at some point to be forgotten.
It's time for one of the biggest hiring events of the year. On September 22nd, Amazon Warehouse Hiring Day will be in your area to showcase all of the things you can get from a warehouse job. There'll be swag, a photo booth, giveaways, and more. Plus, learn about the work, competitive pay, and great benefits. You can even get a job offer on the spot. To find a hiring event close to you, visit amazon.com/hiringday. That's amazon.com/hiringday. Amazon is an equal opportunity employer.